This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Affirm Films' Paul, Apostle of Christ, starring Jim Caviezel, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13, in theaters March 23rd. More information is available at paulmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it!
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. So what happens when an up-and-coming European bioscientist flips from Darwin disciple to Darwin defector? Well, for Finnish bioscientist Dr. Matti Laisola, an expert in the area of enzymes, the journey made a lot of waves, and he tells the story in a new book. It's called Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin to Design. It's co-written with Dr. Jonathan Witt, and Dr. Witt is a senior fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, who joins us now. Dr. Witt, it's wonderful to have you here.
It's great to be on.
Well, thank you. I'm interested to know, what drew you to want to tell this particular story about Dr. Laisola?
That's a good question. I was on a fellow at Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture, and so we were constantly running into and meeting and interacting with scientists that are open to the evidence for design. And his story was just so compelling because he's there in Finland. He also did a lot of work in Switzerland. And he's in a place that's more secular than the U.S., you know, academic situation, even more so, even in a lot of ways more anti-design. And yet he's bravely, you know, once he had moved from a Darwinist to a design proponent, he was even more, more courageous, more willing to stand up for what he believed. The many people with far less pressure on them. And he was able to somehow navigate all that and have a successful career. So at several levels, it's an amazing story. And he asked me to co-write it with him. And so I was able to get to know him. He's a fascinating guy, very, very winsome, good sense of humor. And just it's been a fun ride over the last year putting that book together.
Oh, absolutely. It is a really interesting, fascinating story. Tell us a little bit about his background, because as I mentioned before, he's a bioscientist, bioengineer, an expert in enzymes. And he began as a scientist in Finland. I know you said he spent time in Switzerland as well. But what was his early career like? What exactly does he do, and how did he start out?
Yeah, he started out, he was a bioscientist, a bioengineer, was what he was training for. And that is where you go in, and he focused on sugars and enzymes. Enzymes are a kind of protein. And he goes in and these big labs, they bioengineer, basically change and alter, kind of Frankenstein type stuff, these enzymes for commercial purposes.
Right.
And so much of his career was in the academy, you know, universities like in Helsinki and Zurich. But he also worked for 11 years at Kultor, a big international firm. But he, early in his career, was a thoroughgoing Darwinist. And there was a visit from the Christian apologist, the thinker, philosopher, Francis Schaeffer.
Yes.
And some of the arguments that Schaeffer made really hit home with Matti. He didn't immediately, you know, just drop Darwinism. But he got to thinking, one of Schaeffer's points was that people have worldviews, and often if you challenge their worldview, they'll get very irrational and touchy.
Yeah.
And Matti thought back and realized, you know, I got really touchy when some of my colleagues challenged my Darwinism. Why did I get so touchy? Why didn't I just have a calm, reasonable conversation about the issues? And so that started a journey for him. He started doing some self-reflection, and then with all his knowledge of biochemistry, biology, molecular realm, he was able to pursue a revisit of the evidence for neo-Darwinism to a degree and a depth that most of us, you know, would envy.
Yeah.
And he came out the other side a strong Darwin skeptic and pro-ID.
Well, it's so interesting, the part of the book where you're talking about his encountering, listening to Francis Schaeffer. He commented in that portion of the book that he realized how naive his concept of truth was. Was it the case that when he was espousing Darwinism, that it was more of a knee-jerk position, or had he really thought it through? How would you have characterized his Darwinian outlook prior to that, you know, encounter with Francis Schaeffer and what he had to say?
Yeah, he said that he had not looked into it very deeply. He knew biology very well. He knew experimental biology very well. But Darwinian evolutionary theory kind of comes in as window dressing after the fact, as a story you tell after the fact.
Right.
And so he just accepted those and, you know, did his biology. But then only when he sat down and started looking into it did he realize that, okay, maybe it fits some of the data, but it doesn't fit all the data. And the design explanation explains certain things, like the appearance of biological information, you know, DNA, you know, which is this incredibly complex, sophisticated software we're discovering in every living cell. Design, intelligent design, explains that much better. So it was a process for him. And then it also made him a little more patient when he would encounter, throughout his career, fellow biologists who had done very little thinking about evolutionary theory. They accepted it. They you know, they were good, loyal disciples of Darwin, if you will, but they hadn't really thought through it carefully. Even some really brilliant, we give some examples of some really bright, brilliant guys that when he would challenge them, you know, privately, you know, and these were friends of his, not debate opponents, they would admit, I hadn't really thought about that very much.
Yeah.
So it's just what worldview can do. And when you're in a tribe, so to speak, it's very difficult to want to, you know, stick your head out of that and risk being ejected from the tribe.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is kind of an interesting point that you bring up, which is, I think for we non-scientists out here, there tends to be such a sense of awe. Well, these scientists dealing with these very complicated issues that are way beyond my intellectual pay grade, if they're holding to Darwinian evolution, surely they must be right because they're smarter than the average bear. What you're pointing out and what you point out in the book is the human element of just assuming Darwinian evolution to be true is also a temptation of the most intellectual scientists among us, that they're not immune to that.
Yeah, you don't. You get a PhD in a science field, you put on a lab coat, it doesn't remove you from the human race, from the weaknesses of the human race. And it's also a, you know, and if you studied, we have a discovery that we have several men and women who have specialized in the history and philosophy of science. And if you study the history and philosophy of science, even a little bit, you see that the last thing you want to do is always trust the current consensus on any particular scientific position. You want to give it a fair hearing, of course, but science would never progress if it could never challenge an old existing paradigm.
Right.
There's a famous book by Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he argues that the old paradigms, they don't go out gently. They don't go gently into the night, so to speak, because all these scientists who've invested their entire careers in that old paradigm, they're not ready to let it go, even if the evidence is piling up against it. So,
yeah.
We give some examples in the book, too, of other scientific controversies in the past where scientists did not behave well, did not behave rationally as they clung to that old paradigm. So we shouldn't expect scientists to all be, you know, calm and rational. And here, particularly with Darwinism, because there's a worldview at stake. This comes down to some fundamental beliefs about the nature of reality. Is there a God? Isn't there a God? So we should expect even more histrionic, irrational behavior in this area than in some of these other scientific controversies.
Right. Well, because he said he always laughed at those who believed in a God of the gaps because he thought they were just guilty of ignorance.
Right, right. There's this argument that says, well, people that see design in nature, they're just making a God of the gaps argument. There's something in biology, historical biology, we don't understand, and so they think, God must have done it. and he said, when he was younger, he said, that's a good criticism of the design position. But then as he got to studying it, he realized that evolutionists will put evolution in the gaps of their ignorance. Well, we don't know how that happened, but, you know, evolution, wow, isn't it amazing? and without really a credible, full explanation, they just kind of shove evolution into the gap. And he also realized that a design argument can have a positive element. We see humans, we see intelligent agents creating things like software code.
Yeah. Very interesting. We're going to go to a very quick break. We'll come back with Dr. Jonathan Witt, the book Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin to Design. Stay with us on Janet Mefford Today.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sorbo. I wanted to invite you to offer your full support for the Ministry of Preborn and its leader, Dan Steiner. The team at Preborn is very focused and very successful at saving preborn babies from abortion. Now get ready to write down the phone number and the website so you can join the Preborn team.
Join Kevin Sorbo and me, Janet Mefford, as we support Preborn. The mission at Preborn is to supply pregnancy centers throughout America with sonograms. Ultrasounds are a game changer when it comes to saving babies' lives. You see, when an abortion-minded woman sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby. For $140, you can save five babies' lives. To donate, dial #250 and say keyword baby, or donate securely at preborn.com. Your love can save a life. Call 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229.
Every baby deserves to be born. God bless.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. I'm Janet Mefford Today. Thank you so much for being with us. And I find this so fascinating. The book is called Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin to Design. It's the story of Dr. Matti Laisala. He is an expert in the area of enzymes, a Finnish bioscientist. And he and Dr. Jonathan Witt from the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture have put together this book, Heretic, describing what it's like to go from a Darwinian evolutionist to somebody who embraces intelligent design. And it's just a fascinating story that is told in this book. So, Dr. Witt, when we're talking about the journey that Dr. Laisala made from a Darwinian evolutionist to a believer in intelligent design, what were some of the initial matters that he had to work through in order to begin that first step toward acknowledging intelligent design? What were some of those things that he really wrestled with?
Well, one of them was this idea, and he had accepted it implicitly, because he grew up in Finland, which was a majority, 95-97% of the people there would say, I'm Lutheran. And even in schools, they didn't have the clear separation of church and state rules like they have in the U.S. And so they'd even teach Bible in what we would call the public school system.
Yeah.
But he says there was this demarcation, what Francis Schaeffer called an upper story and a lower story. And in the upper story was kind of a make-believe stuff. You wouldn't call it make-believe, but it was, Bible, things like, morality, all these things. These were viewed as subjective, feeling-oriented, and whereas science, this is the realm of knowledge and fact. And he realized that he had imbibed that binary so that he didn't really take seriously, things like the possibility of God being a designer of creation, of the universe.
Right.
And so he had to get past that implicit assumption first so that he could fairly assess the evidence for and against Darwinism, for and against design. So that was a big one for him, something a lot of us would even think about as an issue.
That's true.
And then the other was just the admitting that maybe he had been wrong, that very, very human nature kind of thing. If you've you've been accepting and advocating something for 10 years, 20 years, it's tough to say, boy, maybe I was just flat out wrong.
Yes. Well, that's interesting. You know, the assumption, and you hear that a lot with some of these scientists, that the assumption is science is the field in which you can discover truth and find it more accurately. But even the most intelligent scientists would admit there are things that science can't answer. So why rely on one field of inquiry to have full knowledge of the universe? That seems almost more ignorant than a God of the gaps.
Right, and it's self-refuting, too. How do you, if somebody says, we should only discover truth through science, well, that's a truth claim right there.
Yes.
You can't arrive at that through scientific investigation of matter and energy. You have to somehow get there through philosophy. And
right.
So it's self-defeating. And so yeah, we need to draw upon other areas of human knowledge and wisdom to get a complete picture.
Well, we do. And it's interesting. One of the things that he says in the book and you write in the book is that the functional atheist's argument for entertaining only material explanations in the sciences just assumes that everything we find in nature has a purely material cause. But he asked, what if that assumption is wrong? So where did that realization begin to affect him scientifically when he began to wrestle with that issue of assuming that everything we find in nature has a purely material cause? What did that do to his thinking as he was moving through this worldview issue?
Yeah, he was, what he confronted there, the technical term for it is methodological materialism. Sometimes it'll be called methodological naturalism. And then it's this rule, and it's an arbitrary rule, it says scientists should only invoke material blind processes when they're trying to explain something they've found in nature.
Hmm.
And for some things, that worked fine because there was a blind material process. Say, you know, a riverbed got carved out by the erosion from years and years of a river. But what about, say, for the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics and chemistry? Can we not consider an intelligent cause there, God there? For him, because he was focused in biology, biochemistry, it was this information problem. Where did the extraordinarily sophisticated information required even for a single-celled organism, even a tiny little bacteria, amazing amounts of biological information architecture. And he realized, why can't I consider intelligent design? If it in fact was designed, and I've got this arbitrary rule that says I can't even consider that, how is that rational?
Mm.
Science is supposed to be, you know, this the most rational endeavor. And yet here I've got this dogmatic rule that says I'm not even allowed to consider this other possibility. So once he rejected that, then he could fairly consider the possibility that intelligent design was the best explanation and weigh them pro and con and just follow the evidence.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Now, when he's doing work with engineering enzymes and microbes, what sort of effect did that have on his views of Darwinian evolution and intelligent design? How specifically within his field, what did he discover?
He was part of, back in the 70s and on to the 80s, there was a lot of optimism about how they were going to be able to go in, for instance, and dramatically improve enzymes to do this or that sort of work. And they were able to, you know, do some things where they would create, you know, like, well, you breed dogs to create a specialist dog. Dogs, I think, are all descended from wolves. And so you have specialist dogs like a greyhound. But the enzymes are kind of like these dogs in that they were able to create these little specialist enzymes, but they weren't able to continue to take the enzymes farther and farther and farther away from the natural type. And they further realized that when they would create this specialized engineered enzyme, and then they would, you know, let it breed and populate in a, you know, these large vats or whatever, eventually it would revert to the wild type.
Hmm.
So the wild type was the robust, kind of the center point. And so this was kind of a reinforcing of his view that he had already developed, that the Darwinian process, which is supposed to be this gradual, step-by-step mutational process of things evolving and changing, it's very limited in what it can actually do. You've maybe heard the distinction between microevolution and macroevolution. Species
yes.
can change, but we don't see them changing into dramatically different species. Darwin theorized that they could, but we don't actually find evidence of that. And Mahi in the lab working with enzymes, we're seeing further evidence that the neo-Darwinian process can only take things so far. It can't take them beyond that species barrier.
Wow, that's interesting. And I think he also said that in examining proteins, they can be modified with random and design methods, but only within these narrow limits. The basic structures have not been changed. So that that also played into it.
Right. So you can only take them so far, and they're using design. He said even the approaches that depended on lots of random mutations, these were carefully designed random mutations that go in and amp up the level of mutations artificially, and they do it in certain ways, and they'd stop when it was helpful, continue the process, focus on a certain area. So even the effort to harness randomness was designed, and it could only go so far. And then the purely designed approaches they took, those also could only go so far.
Mm-hmm.
So there were layers of evidence that design had to be at work to create all these different molecular machines, protein machines that we find in biology.
Right. Well, now, as he's going through this process and he's discovering what he's discovering about the limits of science and the possibilities of intelligent design, what sort of effect did that have on his career? How did those around him react to his transformation?
He got a lot of heat. He was able to end up carving out a very successful career, but things got so hot for him, so to speak, in Finland at one point that he decided to pursue an opportunity in Switzerland at a university in Zurich. Eventually, he was able to come back to his home university in Finland and finish out his career. But there was a lot of pressure. And sometimes it was a case where, say, he would want to put on a debate or a conference where they would fairly look at the ID side, the intelligent design side, and the evolutionary side. And then there would be a hue and cry that would go up because the Darwinists did not want to have this fair and open discussion.
Wow.
Did not want to dignify the design side with something there at the university. And so we tell some stories about how there was lots of clashes in that way. He's a very winsome guy, though, and he would make friends out of enemies, and he and sometimes they were able to pivot, and where it looked like they were going to have complete defeat, they would end up with an alternative approach, and good things would come out of it. So there's a lot of positive. We often hear the stories about people getting sacked who are pro-design, and there's some of that in this book, but there's also some encouraging stories of him making friends in unlikely places.
Wow. That's so interesting. And I bet it's fascinating for him to recall all of the things that went on when he was making the transition that ultimately his scientific mind in some ways really helped him discover the truth.
Yeah, it's a fun story. It's an inspiring story. We kind of came late to the title, Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin Design, because he's not a religious heretic. He's actually, as it so happens, became a very faithful, church-going, passionate Christian, but he's a heretic from Darwinism. He broke from that Darwinian tribe and was labeled, or treated at least, essentially as a heretic. But he was brave, and he, and as I said, winsome, and has made some enemies, but a lot of friends along the way, I was just honored to be brought into the process to help make it. My job was to help make it more readable, to help with examples and illustrations.
Yes.
We had a great working relationship.
Yeah. It's great. Well, the book is great. It's called Heretic. Dr. Jonathan Witt with us from the Discovery Institute. And so good to have you here. Dr. Witt, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Janet.
All right. You take care. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Irwin Brothers Entertainment's I Can Only Imagine, the untold true story of Mercy Me's Bart Millard and the power of redemption and forgiveness. I Can Only Imagine, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters March 16th, more information is available at icanonlyimagine.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. From Affirm Films comes Paul, Apostle of Christ, starring Jim Caviezel, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters March 23rd, more information available at paulmovie.com. Well, this is a really great time of year to reflect upon what Christ has done for us. And it really strikes me again and again how important it is for us as Christians to never compromise when it comes to standing for Jesus Christ or his word. And again and again and again, when I see stories in the news where a Christian refuses to compromise, it really strengthens my faith in Christ. It really encourages me, actually. And you probably feel the same way. Anytime you see somebody who's willing to take a stand and sometimes faces incredible pressure not to take that stand, I find myself praying for that person and really rooting for that person and doing everything that I can do to pray that the Lord will strengthen and preserve the faith of that person as they are standing up against whatever it is that the issue is. And in the case of Julia Ward, you might recall her story. Julia had walked into the room of professors from the counseling department at Eastern Michigan University. She was a graduate student there, and she had hoped to find tolerance among the review board that day. But she soon found out that she was wrong. Her only offense was that she had referred a potential client who wanted advice on his same-sex relationship to another fellow counselor. She didn't want to get involved in this because of her Christian conviction about homosexuality being wrong. And although she was willing to work with all clients, she couldn't affirm a relationship that was contrary to her faith. Julia talked about a little bit of her story. Listen to cut one.
I was told that she would be scheduling an informal review because she, out of all of the years she'd been teaching, had never encountered somebody that refused to counsel homosexuals. Now, I had never refused to counsel homosexuals. I had simply refused to affirm their lifestyle. They kind of went over with me my position, which was the fact that I could not affirm homosexuality because of my relationship with Christ. And they went on to say that because of my stance, I was in violation of the code of ethics and that I had three options that I could choose. The first option was to take part in a remediation program, which would basically show me the error of my ways. The second was to voluntarily withdraw myself from the master's program at Eastern University. And then the third option was to request a formal review hearing where they would actually bring in more counseling faculty to kind of look at the situation and make a decision. And so I elected to do the formal review.
Right. Now, you would think if she was able to get the formal review that there would be some sort of consideration given to her and her convictions and understanding of the First Amendment. Julia outlines what happened during that formal review. Listen to cut two.
I thought that perhaps in the formal review hearing that there would be some understanding and that there would be some tolerance. But I was met with more intolerance. In fact, I was questioned about my Christianity in terms of whether or not I felt my brand of Christianity was better than somebody else who called himself a Christian. And so after the formal review, they told me that I would be informed within a week as to their decision. And within a week, I did receive their decision. Unanimously, they decided to expel me from the program. And so I felt that it was important, and my husband agreed that we find someone that's going to have a Christian perspective. And ADF has that Christian perspective, and I think that that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, this is what it's all about. For help, Julia turned to Alliance Defending Freedom. And as you know, we've been talking a lot about Alliance Defending Freedom in the last several weeks because we know how much good they do for people like Julia, for people like Kelvin Cochran, for people like Jack Phillips. There are so many Christians out there who are finding themselves in circumstances like Julia's. and they are able to turn to Alliance Defending Freedom to defend them at no charge. And this, of course, is not something that is cheap. In order to defend somebody in a court of law, it can be very, very expensive. And that is why we are getting behind Alliance Defending Freedom. Their Freedom Fund goes out and helps people like Julia defend themselves in court and fight not just for their individual freedoms, but fight for our religious liberty at the same time. The Freedom Fund is vastly underfunded right now. We are trying to raise $5,000. We have made a great dent because of your generosity, but we still need 15 more people to give a gift of $100 in order to meet our goal. And we are counting on you this week to step up if you are able to, by the grace of God, and if it's part of your budget and you can afford to donate today any amount. 30 people to give $50 would be great as well. But if you can help do anything to bolster this Freedom Fund, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. So all you need to do is call the number 866-700-1060. That's 866-700-1060. And your gift of $100 will help Alliance Defending Freedom defend your freedom and provide the necessary resources to fight pivotal court battles just like Julia's. And by the way, the court ruled in Julia's favor, and they said that an atheist would not be required to tell people that there is a God, and therefore Julia should not have been required to affirm a relationship that was contrary to her Christian convictions. And she expressed her own thanks and gratitude for the work of Alliance Defending Freedom, underwritten by people like you, because you believe in standing for religious liberty and allowing her to be able to take her case to court and to set that precedent that may help other Christians down the road. Here's Julia, cut three.
When I think about ADF, I think about all of us, the body of Christ, working together. You know, I decided to take a stand for the Lord, and the Lord has positioned them to take a stand for me. And I am very grateful about that, because I look at this as something that's not going to go away. There are other students that may encounter the same problem, and it's not fair for them to have to go through the same thing that I did.
Again, we really appreciate all of your support for Alliance Defending Freedom. And as we continue to invite you to call, please pray, if you would, about being able to donate today. We need 15 more people to give a gift of $100, and we'll be able to meet our goal of raising $5,000 for Alliance Defending Freedom. And there are so many other cases. We've been sharing some of these cases over the last several weeks. Calvin Cochran, the former Atlanta fire chief, who wrote a devotional book in which he talked about homosexuality being sinful and got fired for it. And he ended up finding victory in court thanks to Alliance Defending Freedom. They've also gone to bat, as you know, for Jack Phillips in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. That case was just argued just a few weeks ago, and we'll await a decision coming up in the next few months. But all of these cases are absolutely critical for all of us. If these cases are not taken on, and if these cases are not won and argued constitutionally, then where does that leave the rest of us? So we can step up. We can make a difference in the lives of people like Julia Ward, people like Jack Phillips, and so many others. As we've mentioned, so many different cases. The case coming up over the California FACT Act is another really important case. This is involving the state of California forcing pro-life pregnancy centers to post information about where you can find an abortion facility. I mean, it's just insane. Can you imagine California requiring an abortion facility to tell people where they can get a free ultrasound in order to choose life for their babies? Not a chance, especially in the state of California. But this is another really important case that is coming up that Alliance Defending Freedom is fighting, and they really need your financial support. Again, these clients are not paying for these services. If they had to, a lot of them probably could not afford to do it. But because of your generosity, they can do it. So please call if you're able to give a gift, 866-700-1060, 866-700-1060. And again, if you make that call now, everything you give will be matched thanks to the generosity of a ministry friend. So double your gift. If you give a $100 gift today, that will be like giving $200. If you can give a $50 gift, that will be like giving $100. So it's a wonderful opportunity for you to help people like Julia, people like Calvin, people like Jack, by calling 866-700-1060. And there's also a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you for all of your generosity. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. More ahead.
from Irwin Brothers Entertainment comes I Can Only Imagine. The untold true story of Mercy Me's Bart Millard and the power of redemption and forgiveness.
My dad was a monster, and I saw God transform him. I didn't think that God could do that.
I Can Only Imagine. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. In theaters March 16th. More information is available at IcanOnlyImagine.com.
This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is John's story.
When our daughter Emma was born, my wife and I took a hard look at our finances for the first time, and we didn't like what we saw. My wife suggested that I call Trinity. Immediately when I spoke with the counselor for the first time, she was very helpful and put us on a plan for success. Right away, we knew we'd called the right place. We just want everyone out there who might be in our situation to know that there's help.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752.
From Affirm Films, the studio that brought you Risen and War Room, comes Paul, Apostle of Christ. Two men challenged an empire in order to live out the gospel of Jesus Christ and spread their message to the world.
Where sin abounds, grace abounds more.
Starring Jim Caviezel. Paul, Apostle of Christ, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters March 23rd. More information is available at paulmovie.com.
We're back on Janet Mefford today. From Irwin Brothers Entertainment comes I Can Only Imagine, the untold true story of Mercy Me's Bart Millard and the power of redemption and forgiveness. I Can Only Imagine, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters March 16th. More information is available at IcanOnlyImagine.com. Let's talk a little bit about this whole situation involving Jeff Sessions, the U.S. Attorney General, and this lawsuit against Radical California. Boy, is it radical. Boy, is it radical. We were just talking a couple minutes ago about how California is forcing pro-life pregnancy centers to post information about where people can get abortions. And now that's being challenged in court by Alliance Defending Freedom. But Attorney General Sessions on Friday night defended his department's lawsuit against California's immigration laws. He said that somebody needs to stand up and say, you've gone too far. You can't do it. It's not reasonable. This is a lawsuit that was filed against three California laws that the DOJ claims interferes with enforcement of federal immigration law. This is via CBS News. California is a sanctuary state, as we know, meaning it does not comply with federal immigration laws. And while there are only five other sanctuary states, there are hundreds of sanctuary cities nationwide, California being home to some of the most high profile, San Francisco and Los Angeles. And Sessions said the Justice Department is going to push back against sanctuary cities using every lawful tool that they have to push back against this activity. Ultimately, we have to stand up for our borders. This will not end well unless we begin to return as a nation to the understanding of the rule of law and of national sovereignty and the need for borders. I don't really know what's going to come of this. How in the world can you have a country in which a state is standing up to the federal government on an issue like this? Why? And many people ask this question. Why in the world would these people want sanctuary cities? Well, because they're so far left, that's what they like. And but to a lot of people who are thinking straight on this, you say, why in the world would you do this? Kate Steinle was killed in San Francisco because of this sanctuary city nonsense. Don't you care about the life of an American woman? And you have to conclude, not really. Not really, because they're not standing up for the Steinle family. It's not really about the Steinle family or about any of those other families who have lost people, who have been at the wrong end of a gun held by an illegal alien or, you know, somehow involved in a crime. Here's a perfect example of this in Denver. This illegal alien from Mexico arrested for allegedly causing a fatal hit and run will be free to leave prison should he pay his $25,000 bond? And it's all because the Denver Sheriff's Department remains committed to its Sanctuary City policy. This is via Breitbart. This is illegal alien Ivan Zamparipa, Castaneda, a 26-year-old from Mexico, who was arrested after allegedly fleeing the scene of a fatal hit-and-run crash that involved his truck and a semi-truck. Following the crash, this illegal alien, who was allegedly drunk, fled the scene, and the semi-truck was engulfed in flames, and the driver of the vehicle was killed. He was arrested for vehicular homicide and hit-and-run, which is a felony, but he will be released back into the public if he pays his $25,000 bond. This is insanity. Why would you want somebody like this on the loose? Somebody who did something like this. Somebody died because of this guy. And you're going to just let him post bond even though he's not here legally. It's absolutely crazy. Well, Jeff Sessions was on with Tucker Carlson on Fox talking about this. And I thought this was a very, very important question. If a city government is making it possible for an accused killer to go free, this is really setting up a conflict between state government and federal government. So how can this be stopped? This is what Jeff Sessions said. This is Cut 4.
The American people have got to speak first and foremost to these governmental leaders. It's just unacceptable to take this case in Denver that you just cited, where the individual will be released from jail. Our ICE officers are not going to stop looking for him. They're going to go out to find him. They'll be at greater risk. They'll place people in the community at greater risk to try to make an arrest there when they could have been safely picked up in the custody from the custody of the Denver authorities. So this situation is very, very serious, and it represents a commitment from the hard left, these activist groups, to open borders and non-legal enforcement of immigration. Cannot be the policy of the United States of America.
Absolutely right. And that's why this lawsuit is so important. California's got to get back in line. They're completely out of control out there. Completely out of control. And Californians, many of the right-thinking Californians, will be the first ones to tell you that. It's just out of control in California. So the question becomes, with this insurrection in California, as Tucker puts it, does Jeff Sessions worry about the country holding together? This was his answer, Cut 5.
I don't think so. I think this is an extreme act. When I was in California, I heard countless people tell me they were embarrassed and outraged about what was going on. I think these people have just been able to get away with it and not been challenged, intellectually as to the meaning of what they're doing, how radical it is, how unacceptable it is, how it places the lives of American police officers and ICE officers at greater risk, as well as our communities at greater risk, because we keep criminals in the country that are due to be deported.
Right. Now, you know what's so interesting to me about this is how relatively few voices I'm hearing in the Christian community really honing in on this issue of the nation state, of border control, of national sovereignty, and the rule of law. What I'm hearing a lot of is we need DACA, and we need to reach out to the stranger, welcome the stranger, illegal aliens are our brothers in Christ, or, you know, whatever the argument is. I've talked about this quite a bit on the show, and I don't want to belabor the point. But there was an article that I found, and there are several out there that you can choose from. Mark Tooley wrote a good piece from the Institute on Religion and Democracy about nation states. And I don't see a whole lot of people making a case for the nation state from a Christian perspective. But this was from Semi-Partisan Politics via the Reimagining Europe blog. And it was titled A Strong Christian Case for the Nation State and Against the European Union. So you got to take the context into consideration. They're talking about Brexit and all that. But this writer says this: Christians tend to view the nation state and so the prospect of a European federation differently according to whether they are Catholic or Protestant. All Christians, however, are accountable to the Bible, and what does it say about these matters? On the one hand, the New Testament makes quite clear that a Christian's affection and loyalty have to go beyond the nation. They have to transcend it. Primarily, they have to attach themselves to God and to his coming kingdom or rule. This we read in the third chapter of the Epistle to the Philippians, where Paul, having identified himself strongly with the Jewish nation, calling himself a Hebrew of the Hebrews, then firmly subordinates his Jewish identity to his loyalty to God in Christ. Taken at face value, it would seem that Paul is saying, in this verse here, it's a passage, whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them rubbish that I may gain Christ. Our citizenship, he tells Christians, is in heaven. So he seems to be saying the Christian identity must obliterate and completely replace national identity, but he never entirely repudiated his Jewish identity. He rather sought to understand how his newfound loyalty to God and Christ could actually fulfill his original national loyalty. Right, and of course there's the theological component to it because he's a Jew and he understands that Jesus is the Messiah. So he says we can't be idolatrous about being nationalists, which we understand, but there's another part. This is alluded to by St. Paul's continuing identification with the Jewish people, made explicit in the Old Testament, where the prophet Jeremiah addresses the Jews who had been carried off into exile in Babylonia after the sacking of Jerusalem in the year 586 BC. And he says, "This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also seek the welfare of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it. Because if it prospers, you too will prosper." So though they are citizens of another country, though they are currently exiles in Babylon, the people of God should nevertheless seek the welfare of the city. Why? Because we are human beings. We're finite. We're not gods. We come into being. We grow up in a particular time, a particular community. We're inducted into particular forms of social life and churches and schools and clubs, etc. And these institutions and their customs mediate and embody a certain grasp of the several universal forms of human prosperity or flourishing that are given in and with the created nature of human beings. So it's natural that we should feel special affection for and loyalty toward the communities that have benefited us by inducting us into human goods. And since beneficiaries ought to be grateful to benefactors, it's right that we should. So it's okay to love your country and to want to protect its borders. You can make a very strong biblical case for that, and I wish more people would. And I'm glad to see that the Department of Justice is stepping up. It needs to happen. This hour of Janet Mefford Today brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. 800-793-8752, 800-793-8752, or trinitycredit.org. Thanks for being with us. God bless you. We'll see you next time.